Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Throughout the Trump administration, there were numerous examples of improperly vetted or unconstitutional executive orders, administrative rules, or departmental policies, ranging from voting rights to women's health to immigration policies, all being successfully challenged by a group of women lawyers outside of the government. Or in certain cases, fulfilling the function of government, such as the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, in cases like the Charlottesville white supremacists. Most of the time, we give very little thought to the work, the attorneys, and the stress involved in challenging the government. But legal writer Dahlia Lithwick gives readers an inside view of those cases and the amazing attorneys who challenge Trump policies. Lady Justice was published last year and was one of The New Yorker's best books of the year and a New York Times bestseller. Dahlia Lithwick is the senior legal correspondent at Slate and host of Slate's podcast on legal affairs, Amicus. She's written for The New York Times, Harper's, New Yorker, Washington Post, and won the National Magazine Award for her columns on the Affordable Care Act in 2013. She'll be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa in an event Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at OU Tulsa. And she joins us today to talk about the Supreme Court and her book, Lady Justice, which is published by Penguin. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks so much for joining us here on Studio Tulsa.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for writing Lady Justice. I learned so much about the legal efforts involved in what seemed to be constant lawsuits against the Trump administration for their overreach and illegality in overturning government policies and procedures. But first, I'd like to discuss some of the issues that you've been writing about at the Supreme Court. Recently, the marshal at the Supreme Court said they would not be able to identify who leaked the Dobbs draft decision. I know your opinion, but how likely is it that that leaker is a justice and they did not want to find who actually leaked or announce who leaked the decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the obvious question once the second after Marshall Gail Curley issued the announcement that you're describing, where they said, well, here's this extensive report. We've, you know, looked between the sofa cushions and like shook all the clerks by their ankles and we have no idea. Right after that, she issued a follow-up saying, oh, by the way, we didn't actually subject the justices to the kinds of questioning and interrogation that everyone else in the building had. So you're quite right. I think she described it as it was a voluntary, quote, iterative process, her questioning of the justices, which I guess means it came with like tea and macaroons. But it's really important to know that the clerks and all the other court employees, including, you know, some who were just right out of college, terrified, were being forced to sign affidavits saying that they would be subject to, you know, criminal penalties if they didn't cooperate. So there's this kind of funny upstairs, downstairs vibe where everyone else who worked at the court was treated as though this was a serious criminal investigation with huge consequences and penalties. And then, as you said, the nine justices themselves were not really subject to anything approximating that. And maybe more importantly, their spouses were not questioned. And so I can't answer how likely it is that it was a justice. I think what I can say is, given the parameters of the search, by which I mean everyone else was questioned sometimes multiple times, sometimes, you know, really under threats of professional repercussions, and the justices, I guess, had coffee and said what they wanted to say with no possibility of sanctions or penalties, it certainly increases the likelihood that this search that turned up nobody might imply that the somebody in question was somebody who was not ever interrogated. But we don't really know because the other piece of this is, and there was more follow-up reporting just this past weekend from CNN, just about how lax security was in the court and how, you know, the printers, anybody could have printed at any time. There were these so-called burn bags lying around with classified documents that weren't picked up for days. So I think that the kind of short version of the long story of the leak is it certainly seems as though the justices weren't questioned and may have been involved. It's almost equally probable that the very, very sloppy, archaic security at the court means that somebody just picked something up off the floor and walked out with it.
This goes back to another thing you've been writing about, which has been the lack of an enforceable code of ethics at the court And really, I think that kind of filters down. There's episodes in Lady Justice, which says that's throughout the federal judiciary. What needs to change in your view?
Yeah, this goes to this larger thing. I know we're going to talk about this too, but the public approval rating of the Supreme Court right now is in the 20s. It's the lowest it's ever been since Gallup started polling. And, you know, we should be clear, public approval ratings of, you know, Congress are not much higher, of the president are no higher, the press, you know, all institutions, maybe with the exception of the military, are suffering catastrophic loss of public trust, right? And the reason that matters for your question and for the Supreme Court and the federal courts generally is that the court is the only institution of government that has no power to enforce its will other than public approval, right? So, you know, Congress has all sorts of powers of the purse. The executive branch, you know, is the head of the military, and every other branch of government can, even if they want to do something that's not popular, they can force their will on others, right? This goes back to the Federalist Papers and the fact that the court was meant to be the weakest branch and had neither the power of the purse nor the sword. So it matters that the court has lost the public trust, because the only power the court actually has is the public trust. And when that goes away, the court actually can't do anything to enforce its will on the people, right? And we forget that a little bit because we think, oh, you know, Bush v. Gore, the public didn't really like it, but they abided by it anyway, right? Or, oh, you know, Citizens United, the case that did away with, you know, all the laws on campaign finance reform. The public hated that across partisan lines, by the way, but abided by it. So I think we get this piece of magical thinking where we say, no matter what the public approval is of the court, they can still force their will on the people. But of course, they don't have an army and they don't have a budget. So this really is why your question is so salient, because one of the things that the public is reacting really badly to right now, certainly the cases, and we can talk about the cases, the last couple of years have really come out with some bombshells. But beyond the cases, there's all this extracurricular stuff. So we've already talked about the Dobbs leak. That's the biggest leak in Supreme Court history, and nobody knows who did it. And then we have this other class of things, which you just described, which are these ethics rules, right? That the justices are supposed to be bound by a code of ethics and, you know, canons and statutes that say what justices do in their off time and how they behave and who they pal around with and who they take money from, and which cases they recuse from, except those ethics rules don't apply to the 9 justices on the Supreme Court. And so whether it's in the last couple of years, you know, Justice Amy Coney Barrett flying to the Mitch McConnell Center and giving a speech there, or whether it's, you know, Justice Alito flying to Rome and giving a kind of triumphalist speech right after Dobbs, or the liberal justices speaking at the American Constitution Society, or maybe most notably, Ginni Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, who was clearly involved in some kind of planning around the January 6th events of 2021. And yet Justice Thomas doesn't recuse from cases that have everything to do with documents around that. He continues to hear cases. So all of these issues about the judicial ethics and about, you know, ways that we are now finding out, you know, how money is spent to get access to the justices. There was reporting last week about how Chief Justice Roberts' wife has gotten hundreds and thousands of dollars from headhunting attorneys and putting them into law firms that then practice in front of the court. So there's all of these kind of weird, hinky entanglements. And yet the justices are not bound by the rules. And as you said, there's a lot of rules by which the lower courts are supposed to be bound, but are also not enforceable.
No.
And I think the answer is fairly simple, which is, you know, the Supreme Court needs to have an enforceable ethics code against itself. But more globally, I think that the rule has always been that particularly Article III federal judges who get lifetime appointments, right, you cannot remove them unless you impeach them, have to hold themselves to the highest ethical standards. So the standard isn't, you know, am I taking money from a guy who's got an interest in the case? That's not the standard. The standard is, if I fly out to Jackson Hole and I hang around with people who are lobbying for, you know, an outcome in Hobby Lobby, the contraception mandate case, does that look yucky? And if it looks yucky, don't do it. And the justices seem to have completely, and I don't mean to say all of them, but a lot of them, absolve themselves of the responsibility of looking like they're impartial, looking like they're not political actors. And as I said, that cycles back to these catastrophically low polling numbers.
I think you recently wrote about Abe Fortas, who was going to be the Chief Justice after Earl Warren. That nomination was filibustered. And then later he was forced off the court. And it looks like, once again, the Nixon Justice Department, which probably was the role model for the Trump Justice Department, was doing dirty tricks against him, bringing articles to light, threatening to revive charges against his wife that he was exonerated for, that she was exonerated for. And basically, he was forced off the court for basically what nearly all these justices do today.
It's true. And it was, isn't it interesting? It was a piece of history that I had sort of lost. And it came out of Adam Cohen's amazing recent book about, as you say, the sort of dirty tricks that the Nixon administration deployed to reshape the court when he was president. But almost the most interesting part of that, I mean, you flagged one, which is super interesting, which is, you know, that the Nixon Justice Department just decided they wanted Fortas off the court. And they were like sending the attorney general to have private meetings with Justice Warren, right? Showing these dossiers of things, like really putting the squeeze on Fortas in ways that, as you said, are, you know, kind of shocking. You can't imagine today.
Very mob-like.
Biden Justice Department sending somebody to go meet with John Roberts to get Clarence Thomas off the court. It would be unthinkable. But almost the most interesting part of that research for me was that the court itself pushed Warren off the court. In other words, the justices themselves convened and said, this is way, way, way over the line of what the public can accept. And they were the ones who persuaded Fortas to step down. And one of the reasons I got really interested in that history is every time we have a crisis of confidence in the court, which is, like, as you said, almost weekly now, the justices kind of wave their arms in the air and make it sound like, well, there's, you know, nothing we can do if Clarence Thomas's wife was involved in, you know, the January 6th insurrection, or, well, there's nothing we can do if Amy Coney Barrett's husband has a Washington, D.C. law firm that's profiting from his access to her. You know, clearly at one point, the justices thought they had skin in this game and that it was all of their fight to make sure that the court was behaving with integrity. And as you say, what Fortas was accused of doing, much less what he actually did, is so much less disqualifying than some of the stuff that's coming out today about which the justices say, hey, we don't police each other.
My guest today is Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior legal correspondent at Slate and hosts the Amicus podcast at Slate on legal affairs. Her latest book is Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America, which she'll be talking about and other things court-wise in a BookSmart Tulsa appearance Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at OU Tulsa. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One more question about the court today before we move to Lady Justice. And, you know, I think this is something you wrote. I believe it is. You wrote it. It says, one of the primary roles of the court is to provide certainty into what's permitted constitutionally or what is prescribed. And in the Dobb case, you wrote, the court has done the opposite and created uncertainty. Tell me about that uncertainty.
Well, I think it's really the tragedy of the Dobbs decision is that, you know, at the end of June of 2022, when the court struck down Roe v. Wade and struck down Casey versus Planned Parenthood and said, we're going to send the issue of abortion back to the states. It never should have been a federal question. Now we're going to have the certainty and clarity of the states administering their own abortion rules. And as we all know, what has instead happened is just chaos and confusion in the states. So we have states that, you know, like Arizona, who pass a law and then it's enjoined, or they pass another law and it's enjoined, and it's not clear which of the two pre-existing laws is even binding in the state. You have states like Texas that are passing increasingly draconian laws. You know, we have clinics that close, clinics that open. And more urgently on the ground, we've seen a whole raft of stories. I mean, it starts with the 10-year-old who couldn't get abortion care in Ohio, right? And had to go to Indiana. But what we're seeing around the country is that doctors are not sure what they can do, not sure if they can give drugs that may be abortifacients, which we're seeing around the country. We're seeing women who are literally going septic on tables in ERs as we have committees of hospital lawyers convening to try to determine if her health is sufficiently at risk that we can now do the necessary surgical intervention. In other words, story after story after story that we're hearing is that nobody knows what the law is. Nobody knows what the law is on a college campus in Georgia. Can you drive your pregnant friend across state lines without being hailed back into court in Georgia? We don't know. And so I think that the point I was trying to make in that piece is, whatever your thoughts are about Roe v. Wade, at minimum, what it did was it created a kind of floor so that everybody knew that abortion was, you know, legal under this rickety trimester framework. And then Casey clarified that. But now there's no floor. We don't actually know what the rules are. And state after state after state, you know, about half the states now have passed incredibly restrictive abortion laws. Most have no exceptions for rape or incest. And so you have clinics that are paralyzed. You have caregivers that are paralyzed. Folks are not sure what medication abortion is or where they could get the two medications necessary for a medication abortion. They don't know if they can pop it in the mail to their kid in college in Tennessee. And so my point in that article was, to the extent that being free means having some sense of certainty of what the law is, you cannot be free if everybody is all tangled up in sort of bureaucratic, legal, ever-changing congressional and state legislative landscape about what is lawful and what isn't. And that the people who are suffering the most as a, you know, the victims of this lack of certainty from state to state are the most vulnerable people, are the people who don't have the ability to fly to New York, who don't have the ability to call a fancy lawyer and litigate what's happening in their emergency room, who don't have the ability, you know, to read 1,000 law review articles and figure out what is lawful and what isn't lawful in their state. And so my real sadness about Dobbs is not just, you know, that the court for the first time in history took away a constitutional freedom as opposed to expanded one by overturning precedent. But what they created is this landscape of utter uncertainty and chaos, and it has people paralyzed, and it means that life-saving critical medical care is not being provided. And that's just the opposite of what a free and just society should look like.
Well, let's move to your new book, or your recent book, Lady Justice, which was released in 2022. It delves into the work of mostly unknown litigators who have, through the last administration, thwarted things like the politicization of the Justice Department, illegal policy shifts on immigration, voting rights, rights for immigrant detainees, voting rights, also policing in the country. And you begin your book with a short reflection on Pauli Murray, which is a name I sadly was not familiar with. Why is she important?
If it makes you feel any better, I was also not familiar with Pauli Murray, and I went to law school and studied cases that Pauli Murray had a hand in determining outcomes. So I don't know if that's solace to you and your listeners, but I think Pauli Murray is one of the most important constitutional architects of the 20th century that nobody ever heard of. And so you're exactly right. In a book full of women lawyers who history in some ways might not remember, I needed to anchor it. And I think almost the most important woman lawyer that history may not remember. And here I just want to pause and say, Pauli Murray strongly self-identified as male, but presented as female. So today I think we might say that Pauli Murray was gender nonconforming, but Pauli Murray died before there was even language for that. So I just want to be clear that Pauli Murray today might want to be referred to as they. We just don't know. But I do think that Pauli Murray, having practiced law as a woman for most of her life, would be okay being talked about as a woman in this book, because every door that was closed to Pauli Murray was closed either because of color — Pauli Murray was the descendant of slaves on one side — or because of gender. Pauli Murray wasn't allowed to go to any of the law schools that she applied to because female. And yet, nevertheless, and this is the important part of the story, despite having every single door slammed in her face, Pauli Murray went on to write the argument that really became the spine of the argument that Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund used to win Brown v. Board of Education. That was the case that ended formal school segregation. Polly Murray wrote the spine of the argument that became the most important gender protection case that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was then a lawyer at the ACLU Women's Rights Project, Polly Murray wrote that. And yet the briefs didn't credit Polly Murray. Actually, Justice Ginsburg was good enough to put Polly Murray's name on the brief in the case she filed. But time and time and time again, people used Polly Murray's prodigious intellect and, you know, path-breaking analysis of how the 14th Amendment could be used to vindicate rights for children of color, for people of color, for women and other minorities. And nobody credits Polly Murray. And so I became just obsessed with this question, which is the one you just posed. How can somebody be so central to American constitutional history that they kind of clawed it out of rock face themselves and nobody knows who they are? And to me, that slightly answers the bigger question that I wanted to ask in the book, which is, let's stipulate RBG was awesome, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but RBG didn't do any of this on her own. She always said, I stand on the shoulders of giants. And she would always list this litany of people who kind of worked away in the vineyards without getting credit. One of the people RBG always name checked, by the way, was Polly Murray. Mm-hmm. And it's a way of thinking about justice and doing justice. It goes back to your initial kind of framing about the book, which is that it's a group sport. You know, you don't sit around and wait for the hero to come get you and rescue you. We don't sit around and wait for Bob Mueller or Adam Schiff or whoever the next person is that we think is going to make justice happen. That justice is a thing that happens from the ground up, often by forgotten, invisible people who get no credit. And I guess that was kind of the theme of the book itself. I wanted to lift up a lot of people who I think, you know, changed the world in the Trump years and didn't necessarily get credit. But it's also a little bit a call to action that sitting around and waiting for somebody else to fix voting rights or, you know, partisan gerrymandering or vote suppression or whatever it is, isn't going to save us. We have to save ourselves.
I really enjoyed learning about these amazing attorneys who really took on the government, sometimes at personal cost, because the Trump Justice Department were not good losers and threatened sanctions against people who prevailed against them in court. But out of the people you write about, only two are probably known at all. And that one would be Stacey Abrams, very well known. And then the acting AG, Sally Yates, who only became well known because she was the first official to say no to Trump administration excesses, in that case, refusing to enforce the illegally conceived Muslim travel ban. And you pair that with the next chapter, which was the activist lawyer who helped enforce this prohibition against this illegally conceived travel ban, and that was Becca Heller. I love the way you put those together, and it really tells the story of this initial, you know, there were so many things during the Trump administration that was so outrageous. This was among the first, and we kind of forget it because there were so many more to come. And I'm glad you told that story.
You know, a lot of folks have said to me, like, it's a little bit hard to read this book because I've deliberately repressed some of these really troubling memories of, you know, people remember where they were at the first Women's March. They remember where they were when that first executive order came down saying that, you know, people who were already on planes, right, with lawful visas from Muslim-majority countries were not going to be allowed to enter the United States. They would be turned away. Like, people remember where they were when some of these things happened, when the Nazis marched in Charlottesville in 2017, and we have a chapter on that. And so some of this material is a little bit hard, you know, because our brains don't want to revisit those hard times. But of course, you and I both know repressing history is not a super good way to overcome it or to learn its lessons. And maybe the other thing I would say is that these people that I write about didn't just sort of sit and feel hopeless and didn't say, oh, well, I guess we're just going to turn away, you know, refugees and asylum seekers from countries where their lives are at stake because there's a executive order called the Muslim ban. Instead, they said, we're just going to show up. And one of the reasons the book starts, as you noted, with the travel ban is A, because it's one of the first actions that Donald Trump took after inauguration. So it's one of the first times when we all went, oh, man, he's doing this. But also because for me, Becca Heller's story, and she, as you said, was just this very young activist who had a project called IRAP that was pairing asylum seekers and refugees with volunteer lawyers. She was the person who essentially helmed this massive movement, folks may recall, that when the travel ban went into effect, folks raced out to the airports, right? They raced out to JFK, they raced out to LAX and SeaTac in Seattle and, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth. And they just, every lawyer who could possibly grab a yellow pad ran to an airport and stood there at arrivals with a big sign that said, you know, in Pashto and Arabic, whatever, I'm a lawyer, let me help you. And for me, I guess that's the story I was trying to tell about Pauli Murray, which is that that's when like revolutions happen, right? When lawyers and ordinary people just show up. And so, of course, it was hugely important that Sally Yates, the acting attorney general, who said, as you noted, I'm not going to enforce this travel ban. I think it violates, you know, the due process clause. I think it violates religious freedom. I'm not going to enforce it and put the imprimatur of the Justice Department, you know, on it. But almost more important was the twin side of that story, which is all these young lawyers rushing out to airports, essentially in their cars, white knuckling it, saying, dude, I'm a tax attorney. Like, I don't know anything about immigration law, but I'm going to go stand at the airport and help someone today. And for me, that second story really is the story I wanted to animate the book, because I think there are so many what I call Ruth Bader Ginsburgs, you know, running around amongst us, doing the work, changing the world, getting no credit. Nobody has the tote bag or the mug that says Becca Heller on it, but they did the work. And I think that the amazing thing about the law, as opposed to, you know, what we're seeing now in Iran, when women have to just put their bodies on the streets because there isn't a legal architecture to protect them. But in this country, there is. There's an amazing apparatus and women can access it. And so what I wanted to say is that women with very, very, very little confidence and certainty that they could do things, nevertheless walked into court and won. And that's an amazing triumphal story about why the rule of law matters and why constitutional democracy matters and why we don't have to just go stand on the streets and get mowed down. You know, we have access to really important machinery, but we can't let it rust out. Like, we have to fight for it and we have to lift up the people who deployed it and won.
Well, it's an amazing story. Some amazing attorneys, Roberta Kaplan, Nina Perales, Stacey Abrams, and just a lot of amazing attorneys. We don't know their name, but they did an awful lot of good in protecting rights that were under threat. And it's a great book. Dahlia Lithwick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I cannot wait to see you in Tulsa.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior legal correspondent at Slate and is the author of Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America. It's published by Penguin Press. She'll be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa for an event Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at OU Tulsa. You can learn more at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.